let's go ahead and start, and Steve, we'll get you to walk us through what you have in front of us, and even if we have to have a second work session to have the rest of the discussion, we'll do that, but you can at least get us up to speed.
So, thank you, colleagues. So, a few months ago, we made a commitment that we're going to be spending $15 million a year on homeless services as part of our deal with the county. This last year, in ongoing funding, we spent $11.5 million on homeless services. We spent more than that, but we largely relied on one-time funding. Because I think this council has made a commitment over the past, much of the past decade, that we don't want to be funding ongoing commitments with one-time money. If we have an ongoing commitment, we want to figure out how we're going to pay for it with ongoing money. I suggested when we made that commitment that we should have a work session to talk about ways to address that gap between the $11.5 million ongoing we spent this year and the $15 million ongoing commitment. So it's a $3.5 million gap. The Portland Mercury actually has referred to that several times. I suggest that one way of addressing much of that gap is by adopting a concept that was first floated in the California legislature in 2014. It actually made significant progress but did not pass. Their concept was to have a different tax rate for companies that pay the CEO more than 100 times what they pay the average worker, have a higher tax rate for such companies. And the purpose of that proposal in California was not so much to raise revenue as to address the overall issue of raging economic inequality. As you probably know, over the past few years, economic inequality in the United States has skyrocketed. In the 1970s, the top 1% of Americans in terms of income collected about 10% of all income. And now it's up to around 20%, as this graph shows. That means that if we had the same distribution, now all the money flowing to the top means there's less money for everybody else. So if we were able to magically restore the distribution of overall income to what it was in the 1970s, then everybody other than the top 1% could get a 10% raise, which would help people deal with issues like rising housing costs. Darn, I thought I had this graph too, but what? Oh, it's on the back, sorry. As the back of the page shows, much of the increased income of the top 1% is actually increased income of the top 1/10 of 1%. The top 1/10 of 1% went from having about 2% of all income in the 70s to 7 to 8% today. This phenomenon is particularly acute in the United States, but also a presence in the other Anglo-Saxon countries. We don't have this up on the fed into the PowerPoint, but if you look at other industrialized countries, France, Germany, Sweden, Japan, you don't have this explosion of income at the very top. These figures, by the way, are from Thomas Piketty, the French economist who a couple of years ago wrote the internationally acclaimed book on inequality, Capital in the 21st Century. Now, Piketty also found in his research that to a great extent, this explosion of income at the very top is a result of rising CEO and other top executives' pay in large firms. I think you're all familiar anecdotally with the idea that CEO pay has skyrocketed since the 1960s. In the 1960s, the typical CEO of a large corporation made about 20 times what the typical worker made. Now, in many big companies, they make over 300 times what the typical worker made. So this is an obvious example of spectacular economic inequality. But what Piketty found is it's not just an example, it's a driving force. He found that 60 to 70% of the people in that top 1/10 of 1% are chief executives or other top executives at large firms. So if we could do something that would reduce the gap between CEO pay and typical worker pay, that would make a significant difference in affecting inequality overall. What?
So is the goal of this to reduce the pay or to get to tax it more?
The goal of this is to basically put shareholders on the side of the workers, because shareholders divide up the after-tax profits of a company. So if the profits are being taxed at a higher rate, when there's a bigger ratio of CEO pay to typical worker pay, then that means that shareholders seeing this would realize, well, if we raise the pay of the typical worker and reduce the pay of the CEO, then we'd be paying a lower tax rate and we have more profits to divvy up. So it creates an incentive for these big companies to close that gap, which would result in both raising the income of the typical worker and reducing the income of the CEOs. Now, obviously, what we do in Portland, Oregon is not going to dramatically change the behavior of the Fortune 500. But one thing I think we've seen in the past few years with issues like paid sick leave and minimum wage is that you see an idea that starts in one city and then spreads to other jurisdictions. And I think if we do this, then other jurisdictions will follow us. And ultimately, you'll have enough jurisdictions doing it that shareholders will get the message and there will be downward pressure on raging income inequality. By the way, I mean, this extreme level of inequality isn't just bad for workers in the economy. In my view, it's bad for democracy because the people on the top 0.1% are the people who can fund super PACs that can buy elections, among other things. One important fact to note is that this proposal would only apply to publicly traded companies and could only have been put into effect this next year. Historically, although we have anecdotal information on the CEO pay ratio, we don't have complete information. The SEC next year, as part of Dodd-Frank, will require all publicly traded companies to disclose these ratios starting in 2017. I'd asked Thomas Lanham at one point, could we apply this proposal to all companies? And he said, well, we wouldn't know what the ratios are. And if we asked all companies for those ratios, we'd have to hire an army of auditors to figure out if their answers were correct. But he was comfortable with applying this just to publicly traded companies because for those, the SEC is doing the job for us and is saying they have to disclose these ratios. And of course, I think a large percentage of big companies with wildly overpaid CEOs are publicly traded companies. And the Revenue Office has concluded that this proposal could raise in the neighborhood of $2.5 million a year, which would address a significant chunk, although not all, of the gap between what we are spending and ongoing now on homeless services and what we've committed to spend. So at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Javier Mena from the from Housing to talk about the joint office and our commitment in homeless services. And after that, I'll ask Terry Williams, Revenue, to walk through how the proposal will actually work.
Good morning, mayors, commissioners. My name is Javier Mena. I'm the assistant director at the Housing Bureau. I've been asked to talk about the joint office and we're in terms of the commitment that the city and the county have made. As you are aware, early this year, the city and county decided to enhance the relationship and by creating the joint office and address homelessness. It was as we were preparing to establish this joint office, we began to look at the budget and what would that look like. We looked at previous year's fundings as well as the unprecedented need that we have and what it would take to really put a dent in regard to this issue. In doing that, we established a $15 million baseline for funding, understanding that through the general budget cycles, we only had 11.5 available for ongoing. And so the remaining was set as one time. Not only did we fund the $15 million, but we also added another $9 million and in total was for a total budget of $24.5 million to the joint office. And the county also invested roughly about $22 million in this regard. We have passed along a one-pager that shows what the categories in terms of the joint office investments are and the budget associated with that. So as of right now, as it is it is our understanding that 99% of the contracting has been completed by the joint office, and we have advanced 2 months' worth of investments to the joint office.
Javier, I have a question. Thank you for this one-pager. Has any money been allocated to homeless services at Terminal 1 North?
Not from this budget, no. Actually, no money from the city has been allocated to operations to the Terminal 1.
And has the joint office taken a position on the proposal for homeless shelter Terminal 1?
I can't speak for the joint office. I know that they have, Mark has been working.
If you can't speak for them, I don't want to put you in that position. I was going to ask the county chair. And do you have a budget ask in the fall bump relating to Terminal 1 North?
We do, yes.
And what is that?
It's in regard to the lease payments that are required and some mandated per the lease. For example, a fence that needs to be in the lease. It speaks to that fence that the Bureau needs to put up a fence. So it's related to those costs.
And what's the amount, what's the placeholder amount?
I believe I don't have the amount. I can send it to you. I don't want to speak out of terms in terms of the amount.
And when do you anticipate finalizing a lease for review with Bureau of Environmental Services?
We've been working with BES. Our hope is to get the lease, at least within the Bureau, completed by the end of this week, early next week, so we can share with BES.
Okay, thank you.
So I don't understand how you can put up a fence, because you're not allowed to do any permanent improvements under this state of emergency.
It is a temporary fence. It is not a permanent fence.
Well, Commissioner Fritz, there's some other issues that the developer has raised, punching holes in the building, changing egress and ingress, and that may explain some of the holdup in getting a lease, because our understanding is you can't make those kinds of improvements. But we're waiting for a lease that describes the space that they want to lease, the terms that they're willing to offer, and when they anticipate having this online. And when we get that, then we'll review it. But the legal advice we've gotten is that you can't make any permit changes.
Yes, if Terry could walk through how the mechanics of the tax proposal would work. Thank you.
Good morning. How are you? Thank you. This proposal is a surtax. So it's a tax on a tax, which means the companies would calculate their normal business income tax the way they normally do. And for those publicly traded companies that have a CEO ratio that meets the qualifications, they would pay an additional tax on what their base liability is on the city's business income tax. So the proposal is to have two ratios with two different tax rates. The first is a ratio of 100-1, which would result in a 10% tax rate. So they'd pay 10% additional amount based on, so as an example, if they owed $1,000 in their regular business tax and they had the 10% tax because they had the 100 or 150-1, then they would add $100 more. So then it'd be $1,100. So the $100 would be the amount additional, if I did that math right. The second rate would be a 250-1 ratio, and that proposed tax rate is a 25% tax rate. So in that same example, then instead of $100, it would be $250 for something 250-1, 300-1. Whatever. So that's kind of the mechanics of how that tax is actually done. With it would only be for those publicly traded companies that are doing business here under all of our regular rules. So if somebody is a publicly traded company, their headquarters in New York, they don't have any property here or personnel here or anything like that, then they're not going to be subject to it. So it's just for those that are already subject because they've got those items here, they're doing business in the city of Portland.
And do we have a list of those?
We have an estimated list, because understand that, so we've got information from the SEC's website, looked all that, because the CEO pay has had to have been reported for a number of years, so that's not a new piece. We have, of course, we know everybody who pays the city's business tax. So we did a comparison of those and used that for a calculation. So the one factor that we don't have information about is what that median worker income is. So we have a list, and we've got some speculation about that, but that doesn't necessarily mean for sure that they're the ones that are actually going to be subject, because we don't have that key actual piece of data. We've used some industry averages to get that piece.
Yeah. But the list that we have is approximately 500 publicly traded companies that historically have done enough business in Portland to be subject to our business income tax. Is that correct?
The list is those that have paid at least a minimum tax with us, that so they have enough business here that they've got the seat that they're publicly traded and that medium income, and we did that. And it's between 500 and 550 is our estimate.
So how will we get the median income number?
When in 2017, then that is a required reporting addition to the SEC. And so we will be able to go to the SEC website and pull that down for those businesses that file here.
Can I ask you, one of the things that I find difficult to divine sometimes at the federal level is how people are paid. And it seems like every time there's a federal reform, then the lawyers come in and change the compensation model and claim that it's something other than it is. So, for example, how do you, under this proposal, how do we intend to define executive compensation?
We're going to define it the exact same way that the SEC does. We're going to use those rules. They're going to use that reporting mechanism. So we're not trying to create something different, because that would just add administrative burden and costs.
So how does the SEC define compensation?
I don't have the exact piece, but it should include base salary, bonuses, stock options. So it's just not the direct pay. It's going to look at a more complete compensation package.
And how does the SEC value stock options, particularly in light of the fact that stock goes up and down?
When an individual is granted a stock option, at the time of granting, it is valued at a particular price, because that is then what they're potentially taxed on. And so that would be what I would expect to be the value that it would be used. So there's a grant price, there's an exercise price.
And how does the SEC factor in discretionary bonuses and the timing of those bonuses?
They should be included at constructive receipt at the time that they're given. So that would go into a compensation as well. It should.
Does that effectively mean that compensation is always a one-year trail? Steve is nodding. I'm not sure I used the proper language, but we're always looking back a year. Is that right?
Basically, just like when we get paid, is for a calendar year. And if you got a year-end bonus on the 31st of December and you have constructive receipt of it, then it's going to go into that year. If you don't actually have constructive receipt until the next year, then it would go in and figure into the next year. So there's very specific accounting rules as to when those have to be included or not.
So you don't have a guesstimate yet of, so there are 550 or so publicly traded companies that pay the tax. We don't know yet how many of them would be over or under these thresholds, right?
That's correct. We don't know exactly. Based on some work by the Economic Policy Institute, they have provided some estimated CEO to median worker amounts. And so that's what we use to do our estimate. But we won't have an exact comparison until that filing is actually required after tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2017.
I think it's fair to say, just thinking about the universe of businesses out there, that somewhere less than 10 of these companies are probably based here.
As you mean based as in a headquarters?
Yeah.
I don't know the exact number. We don't have a lot, but there are lots of them that have significant operations.
Right. Headquarters.
Yeah. Whether a headquarters is here or not, that isn't necessarily going to increase substantially the tax that they owe us.
Right.
It depends on what that headquarters does.
Right. I understand that.
Yeah.
It's just in terms of community acceptance.
Yeah.
of the idea. I suspect it's a fairly small universe of companies that are among the 545 that are based here, and whether they fail or pass the test, we'll find out.
In that point, Mayor, so I assume this would apply to companies like Nike,
right.
Adidas,
sure.
Precision Cast Parts, Intel. I mean, are those among the top Oregon companies to which this would apply?
Without having seen the list myself, I can only say I would assume so. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. It would apply to them and potentially McDonald's and Exxon and so on. Yeah.
I just want to add that I've looked up to see what Jim Pyro makes at PGE, and he makes this year a mere $3 million a year. So given that PGE pays pretty well, my guess is they would not be subject to the surtax.
Right.
So if they're doing operations in the city, they would be subject to it?
Yes. So you could have a company that is headquartered in San Francisco, as an example. And if they have employees that are here, if they have a store that's here, if they have a communication center where they, a call center, say, where they have orders coming in, all those things create nexus with the city of Portland, and therefore that they have to, they're doing business here and they have to pay that business income tax.
And how does it work for franchises? You Commissioner mentioned that McDonald's and many of those are independently owned.
Many franchises have both franchisees, so the McDonald's as an example, where you have an individual that buys a franchise and it's their business and they operate it under that brand. They also have company stores. And so those company stores that are operated by the McDonald's Corporation itself then is also creating nexus because of those company stores, as an example.
Would we then look into whether the franchisee is at the these ratios?
No, the franchisee is not a publicly traded company, and so that they wouldn't qualify. Those are likely, it could be a corporation, somebody who decided to get 5 McDonald's franchises in the state of Oregon could easily have incorporated their business in order to do that. But that doesn't mean that they're publicly traded. So they would not, in that case, be subject.
So obviously you're headed towards this. I think it will be very helpful to the council to see this. You're going to be able to get down to examples.
Yes.
Of corporation compensation, what the tax effect would be, right? So I'll take Under Armour as an example. Under Armour is not located here. I mean, they're not headquartered here.
Right.
They are assumed to have operations here. Mm-hmm. They're a publicly traded company that would be on this list.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see how much business income tax they pay and how much more they would pay if they exceeded this threshold.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned $1,000 and $250. I suspect actually the numbers are going to be bigger.
They're bigger, but
in this case, it's because Standard Insurance and Nike and those kind of folks are paying. They're among our larger payers, but the marginal impact of this, I think, is important to remember that our tax is 2.2% of net income.
Mm-hmm.
So this is 2.2% plus 25% or 10% of that.
Yeah.
So it's still going to be a relatively large number, but I bet the typical example is going to be they pay $50,000 in taxes and now they're going to pay $12,000 more.
Right. Or $100,000.
So, I think it will be helpful to all of us. Mm-hmm. The concept is becoming clear thanks to this discussion, but to see its actual real world impact, and we can measure that in our own minds and judgment about, well, this is a Fortune 500 company, they made this much in profit the last year, their CEO has paid this much, and their new Portland tax liability is going to go up by this much. I think we'll get a sense of the impact and proportionality of this. Again, it's sort of strange territory in that it's us basing local tax law on a national set of data, but they are, after all, Portland taxpayers already, and the question will be how much differential does this actually create company by company? I think that'll be very illuminating for all of us.
And we could bring some examples of what, so that you could see that. We sanitize them in a way.
Yeah,
but we could certainly show you kind of how that would work. With
Commissioner Novick, we have a, in the not too distant past, an example where the Portland Business Alliance actually supported a surcharge on the business license feed for schools. And so there was, at a certain point in history, seemed to be such a compelling need for additional revenue that there was buy-in. Two questions. What has been the feedback you're getting from impacted taxpayers? And two, what is the public process that you intend to go forward on to not only to solicit feedback, but also to consider alternatives?
Well, I've called the Portland Business Alliance, and I called people at various companies who could conceivably be affected. The Portland Business Alliance's reaction was quite negative, although I won't quote anything they said. When I talked to people in individual companies that could conceivably be affected, they were not happy, but they were not apoplectic. They had kind of a measured response, which I thought was kind of interesting. We've already had some public discussion of this. I mean, there are some newspaper articles written. We've got a hearing scheduled for October 5th, and we will have experts coming in from one expert from the Institute for Policy Studies, for example, to talk about the overall issue of income inequality and CEO pay. I suspect that hearing to garner a lot of attention and a lot of testimony. And then it's my intention, partly because all of us are very busy with other things over the next month or so, to postpone and vote on the proposal until sometime in November or December.
And please tell me that that scheduled date is the only thing that's on the cap, the only thing that we'll be doing at that particular time. It's not into a morning. When is it?
It's 2:00,
good.
Time certain, 2:00.
And there's nothing else on that day, I hope. Right? Did you put it down for 3 hours?
Did we put it down for 3 hours?
Well, colleagues, let's not skip. I'm very interested in this. Some of the questions I have will come to light at that time. How many companies? What's the impact? If it's $1,000, then probably that's the cost of doing business in Portland, and a mega business company wouldn't think that they have to leave. Because, you know, you said about sick time, and there was the concern there that people would just choose not to locate their latest subway in Portland because there's an additional burden there. Of course, we said actually you should be wanting to put your subway business in Portland, because then we'd all know that your employees were not working sick. And in fact, we didn't get that. But, you know, I think we do have to think about, with Under Armour, would they have been dissuaded from coming here had we had this, depending on, again, on what size of a hit they would be taking? And secondly, are there any companies that now have such a minor showing here in Portland that they would pack up and go elsewhere?
When we get down to cases and examples, it is going to be very interesting. I mentioned Under Armour. I suspect they will pass this test, not fail it. But in other words, they will be under the 100-to-1 ratio from what I know about the company. But that's a guess. We'll find out. And so we'll be able to know. So what are the kinds of companies that we're talking about? Are they banks? Are they national retailers? Are they manufacturers? I don't know. But we need to know, and we will know by that point in our deliberations about this. That we know that the pattern exists among publicly traded companies, that some of them are paying their CEOs astronomically more than their workers. But exactly what kinds of companies they are and what their role in the Portland economy is stuff we need to know, and Terry and the Bureau will make sure we have that data in front of us, in front of the community, before we proceed.
And the other thing, like Commissioner Fish said, how does that compare with what you were proposing this spring? Who are we going to be thinking about doing that as well, or something else? Because I think that there are options open and pros and cons to all of them, so that'll be a good discussion.
Different approach that accomplishes some of the same purpose, which is if there is a need for the city to have additional revenue to do our job, do we enact a general revenue increase of minor impact, whatever that may be, and that was a dime per month for a typical taxpayer, or do we connect that tax revenue, that revenue decision, with policy? And that's what Steve's suggesting that we do, that we have other agendas besides paying the bills. One of them is equity, another is income inequality. I think this is a creative idea that we need to thoroughly vet, thoroughly air, think about, hear about from people that will like it and people that will not like it. but I think the facts are friendly, and I bet the facts are going to be not only interesting, but in some cases surprising about who this would impact and how much.
And that's a very good point, and depending on, again, the impacts, if we clearly state we're doing this and we're not doing the other, because I would imagine that the business community is going to start wondering, when are we going to call it good?
One question for Terry, and we've had discussions about this. How much detail will we actually be able to share legally? I think we've had some back and forth about whether we can even identify publicly the companies that might be subject, and I want to have discussions with the city attorney about that. My understanding is that we definitely can't say how much in tax an individual company pays unless they tell us that it's okay to do that.
That's correct, because all of the financial information, including the amount of tax paid, is protected under under the city's laws. It's all confidential, so we can't release that on an individual basis. That's why when I talked about giving some examples, we can kind of do some blending and get some general statistics about potentially the types of businesses that we believe are potentially affected. And I keep using that potentially because we don't know, because we're lacking a very key piece of information. But we can present some information kind of in more generalized terms, but probably not give you a list that we think it's this company, this company, this company, this
company.
Well,
at some point, though, Commissioner Novick, if we were to collect the tax but not disclose who's paying it, doesn't that defeat the purpose of this exercise?
The companies will know that they're paying it. So that is the purpose is achieved by the companies and their shareholders becoming aware that they're paying a higher tax rate. And again, the idea here is to start a trend where a number of jurisdictions adopt this, and I think that any shareholder will be able to look at the SEC ratios and realize that there's lots of jurisdictions adopting this proposal, and they will start to wonder whether they should reduce the ratio.
Let me delve into it. I hadn't thought completely through the confidentiality issues, because you're right, we can't disclose individual taxpayers' information unless they say that's fine. And some of them might want to do that, and we might want to extend that invitation to say, you know, if you're interested in helping the council understand how this gets down to cases and you're willing to disclose, please do. So we might want to extend that invitation to the folks that would potentially be affected by this. Some of them might have no problem with letting their shareholders know this information, so they might not have any problem telling us. But I assume, Terry, that you'll be able to characterize this. You will be able to say national banks, for example, because there's more than one of them. It won't affect any particular national bank if you tell us what happens, that there happen to be four or five national banks that would be potentially subject to this. You can say national retailers. You can say, national petroleum companies. You're going to be able to do this by category that, again, even if we don't get particulars about particular companies, you know, I'm not trying to do this in a sneaky way that everybody knows who we're talking about here. No, we don't need to know that. But we do need to know how many of these are, what the categories are, and how many of them are, what kind of operation they have here. In other words, do they have a toe in Portland, or do they have, a quarter of their weight in Portland? I think that will be useful information for us.
Yes, I believe that we'll be able to paint some broad strokes for you with that information.
And I think at the hearing it would be helpful just to explain about publicly traded corporations, because I think others like me don't really quite understand that. For instance, I know that OHSU is a public corporation,
but they're not
traded.
Publicly traded corporations have their stock on their stock exchange.
Yeah.
Worked for a non-publicly traded corporation that was employee-owned, and where the CEO made 20 times or less the salary of the lowest-paid worker. I know there's a huge variety in how companies do this.
Really appreciate Terry's and Thomas's and the rest of the Revenue Bureau's work on this because we started batting around this idea a number of months ago. I just wanted to make three observations. One is to go back to what the mayor said about this is a surcharge on our existing tax. And, of course, Portland is somewhat unusual in having a business income tax. So the companies that do enough business here to be subject to it have already made a decision that they're willing to subject themselves to a 2.2% profits tax. So the question they would face if we adopted this is, are they willing to subject themselves to a 2.42% or a 2.75% profits tax by virtue of their having an extreme ratio? The other thing I wanted to note is that the gap between what we've committed to and what we spend in ongoing on homeless services isn't the only fiscal issue that we'll have to deal with next year. If, for example, the council approves the proposed police settlement, then that creates an ongoing $6.8 million obligation. So we're going to get continued extraordinarily good news in the revenue forecast, or we're going to have to find some additional revenue somewhere, or make cuts, which are never pleasant. The last observation I wanted to make is that generally in the city, we rely on fairly regressive means of raising revenue. The business profits tax is probably the most progressive, but the most progressive, but the property tax is not all that progressive, especially given the way Measure 5, particularly Measure 50, operate here. The utility license fee, I think, does not operate in a particularly progressive manner. So I think if the federal government under a different president adopted a revenue structure that's as regressive as the one that we have here, I think that we'd probably, frankly, all be appalled. So this would be a step towards making our revenue system somewhat more progressive in that it would apply a higher tax to the profits of companies that engage in regressive payroll practices.
One other resource that occurs to me that we might want to have Andrews here. As I recall, Josh Harwood, I know this is anecdotal information, but Josh did some interviewing of companies about their tax burden in Portland earlier this year when we were considering an increase in the business income tax. And he had some very interesting reactions from some of the financial folks at those large companies that he talked with. So I think it would be useful for the council to hear those, again, even if it's somewhat anecdotal information about how big a deal our tax burden is for those companies. The answer, I'm basically coy about this, is, you know, what he heard is it wasn't a big deal. But I'll let him describe those conversations in more detail, because I thought that was important information. Steve, what else do we need to know about or prepare for on this issue?
I think that, I'll ask Katie, do you think we've covered what we meant to cover? So again, we're going to have the hearing on time certain, October 5th, 2 p.m. I look forward to that discussion, and I really appreciate the discussion we've had here.
Just have one more question that is about dedicating it to homeless services and how that would be set up, you know, similar to what we discussed for the marijuana tax should it pass.
Please,
that's why Andrew's here.
Just Andrew Scott, City Budget Director. Commissioner, you're pointing out we do, in fact, have a policy against dedicating specific general fund revenue. In conversations with Commissioner Novick's office, the concept as it's proposed right now would not actually dedicate the revenue from this specifically for this purpose, but it does link them in the sense of saying, if council approves this tax, we will simultaneously increase our Cal target to the Portland Housing Bureau to fund the joint office. But they would not be linked further than that in the sense of if this tax went up or down, that would not necessarily change that that allocation.
And we would only start it in 17, so we're not actually taking care of the problem for this next budget, right?
We would need to talk about the timing in terms of, when it comes in and how quickly it would start coming in. It may not take care of the problem in 17, 18. I'm not sure about that.
Can you repeat the question?
Is it an option for the council to do this in a way that affects this tax year versus next?
Most likely not, because we don't have the data that would be publicly reported. Right. And so that's so kind of where the timing is for the 2017
tax year.
As a matter
of law, we could probably do it, but the data is not available then.
It would make it much more difficult to try to get that information, more expensive, all that kind of stuff.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
And can we only have it come into effect at the one time of the year, or is there any opportunity for making it a quarterly requirement?
Well, companies would certainly, if they've got an increased tax burden, they're going to increase their quarterly payments that they make to us through the business taxes, but we won't know how to allocate that out and what that actually represents, if it's a regular tax burden or this surtax, until we actually get the return. And so that's based on when it's filed. So it will come in at different times throughout the year because of different year ends that publicly traded companies might have. They might not all be December year ends. They could be March. They could be September. But we won't get it until they actually file, and so that, with their calendar, that would be the April deadline.
And would there be any kind of an appeal process that, for somebody to say, no, you've calculated it wrong?
Any determination that we make has got an appeal process, but since we are using the data that they're supplying to the SEC, we're not changing it or doing anything like that. It's going to not... there's not going to be much room for an appeal, I guess is what I'd say.
And I forgot what I was going to ask. It's about the budgeting and knowing, moving forward, supposing a company sees the light, as Commissioner Novick is hoping that they will, and changes its payment structure. The following year, they would then not get taxed, or taxed less if they go down from 250 to...
That's correct. So let's say that they were at 127%, and then the following year, they change it, so then they're at 99 to do that. So then they would not be subject to that tax, so that revenue would go down, as an example.
And presumably, once we know how many there are, you'll be able to assess how many staff you'll need to do the administration.
Well, we believe that it's approximately half a person, and it's more of a mostly auditing, so that... is where most the bulk of the work is going to be. It is a little bit more, you know, with our regular entry and calculation, because we have to enter more and split it out. But for the most part, it's auditing those returns and making sure and pulling the data from the SEC and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Just out of interest, are we prohibited from doing an income tax surcharge?
An income tax surcharge. So, oh, on the state income tax?
Yeah. Could we do a local income tax in a progressive manner?
Yes, I believe the city attorneys would say yes, we could.
Well, I think that's very interesting.
Here he is.
Yeah, because everybody thinks that one day they'll be making $1 million a year, right? So I'm not going to tax those people. It might be me one day.
Commissioner Fritz, thank you very much for raising the dedication question, because actually that's something we've had a lot of discussion about, and we don't want to get into a situation where we have dozens of $2 million dedicated pots. But I thought that the solution that the budget office suggested, which is that if we do this, we raise the CAL target, was an elegant way of addressing it without ridiculous administrative burden.
Yeah, I like that. And unlike the marijuana tax, we wouldn't refer this to the voters. We would do it, and somebody could gather signatures on it. Is that correct? Yeah, so to me, that's part of the issue, too, is I suppose if it did get referred, we could, at that point, could we do something to make it more likely that people would not vote no on it?
Well, at this point, I will reveal the results of private polling, which shows that 70% of Portlanders supported this idea in broad strokes and 15% were opposed. So I think that, as with paid sick leave, that would be a deterrent to anybody trying to refer it.
And that's with no dedication.